The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, as we focus on answering your questions via email and live calls, actually, that for those of you who want to do that, the phone number is 970-530-0556. We broadcast live pretty much every Monday between 2:30 and 3 p.m. Mountain Time. So if you're listening during that time, feel free to give us a call if you've got a question that you'd like answered live on the air. 970-530-0556. For the rest of you, we're going to answer email questions. We get quite a few of them every single week. So this episode, as normal, we're going to have a mix of a few Social Security questions and then some non-Social Security questions, usually involving some type of retirement plan question, but they can be practically anything. So welcome. My name is Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Solnier as well. He's rummaging through the pile of emails to decide what we're going to tackle first today. Have you come to a conclusion?
Well, we've got a ton of Social Security questions, so I'm trying to break it up, though, between Social Security and non-Social Security.
Well, what's first?
Social Security, because we've got so many of them.
Okay. Sounds good.
That tells you something, doesn't it?
It tells me what I've said for a long time, the system is way too complicated.
You think?
Way too complicated.
Because literally, we could probably do the next two or three Q&A shows on just Social Security Q&As.
Mm-hmm. And it's the type of thing, as I've mentioned before, you get one shot at doing it correctly for the most part. There is the withdrawal your application provision, but you only get that once. It's kind of difficult to do. You have to pay back all the money they've paid you, and you can only do it for a short period of time. So for most people, there's no practical way to do over if you make a bad decision up front. So you want to get all your ducks in a row, as they say, before you make that initial application for benefits, because it's the only chance you've got to do it correctly. So I understand people's nervousness about doing the wrong thing with Social Security.
But even when you think you're doing it correct, Chris, you and I recently were helping some clients of ours who live on the west slope of Colorado, down near Durango. Don't give away anything on the clients, but remember their case. The husband was married for 10 years to his ex-wife, and they got divorced. And he went in, per our recommendation, we suggested to him to try to delay his Social Security to 70. He liked that, and he chose, in his mind, that made the most sense for him. Mm-hmm. But we told him he would be able to file a restricted application because he was grandfathered in under the old rules. In other words, he was born before January 1st, 1954. So when he reached his full retirement age, which he did about a month ago, he could go to the Durango Social Security office, file a restricted application for the spousal benefit under his ex-wife's earnings and allow his earnings to continue to grow to 70. Now, till his age 70. You can't do that anymore unless you were born before January 1st, 1954. He was. And he went to the office and he was told he couldn't do that. And if you remember the story, Chris, it wasn't that they said he couldn't file a restricted application. They said because his wife had actually suspended her benefits, his ex-wife had suspended her benefits. And the story turned out, he found out later, she was being subject to the, he thought it was because of the earnings test, but it would make no sense, I told him. I think what the case was, the wife suspended so she could earn delayed retirement credits. She had claimed early. When she reached her full retirement age, she suspended her benefits. Anyway, Social Security denied his claim not once, but twice, based on, as you know, Chris, if you suspend your benefits now under the new rules, no one can collect, what do they call them?
Auxiliary benefits.
Mm-hmm. Unless it is a divorced spouse you are collecting on. Why don't you explain a little bit about why they have this exemption and tell our listeners what our client ended up having to do to get Social Security to realize they made a mistake.
Well, the reason why they have this exemption, normally when you're married to your spouse, of course, which goes hand in hand, you cannot file spousal benefits, file for spousal benefits unless your spouse has claimed themselves. So it's kind of like a switch that they turn on that then allows you to claim. But when you're divorced, they were worried that people would choose not to file or would suspend just to get back at their ex to shut off their Social Security benefits. So to eliminate this vindictive behavior, there's the exception that if it's a divorce situation, if it's an ex-spouse, their claiming status does not affect your ability to claim your potential spousal benefits. So that's really the case here, and they misinterpreted that or didn't realize the people they were talking to at Social Security at the office didn't realize that this exception existed.
And it was the Durango office. Mm-hmm. We've had on the Front Range here on this part of Colorado, it's usually the Greeley office that has gotten things wrong. This was the Durango office. Mm-hmm. Told this gentleman not once but twice.
Right.
Because he came home, sent us a long email that he couldn't do it, and he actually tried researching it online, found some information online that kind of supported what Social Security was saying. But that article, which was written by a very bright gentleman, was just old. It hadn't been updated for the law change. So we told him to go back that he can do it. He goes back, is told again he can't do it. His solution was to go to the Montrose Social Security office. So he drove, that's pretty far away. Montrose isn't a hop, skip, and a jump from Durango, is it? I don't think it is.
I think they did it on the phone, Jim.
Oh, they didn't drive there?
No.
Oh.
It's a better story, though, driving through the mountains.
Well, it would have been a prettier story.
In the winter time, yeah.
It wasn't a winter, it was just last month.
Over there, winter starts early.
But Montrose.
Loveland ski area has over 80 Loveland, inches of snow already.
It looks like a good year for snow in the Colorado mountains if anybody wants to go ski. But the Montrose office knew right away.
Got it right.
And got it right and actually approved this man's claim. The reason we shared this case, and we have many, many, that my own mother about 6-7 years ago had a similar case where she was told she couldn't do something after I had told her she could. And she just happened to have the paper from the Social Security's website that I had given to her, proving to her that she could do what I told her she could do. But a lot of the office workers are not true experts on Social Security. And Chris and I don't pretend to be true experts, and he's even more knowledgeable than I am. But we sometimes know more than some of the workers there, Chris. I think what we're trying to get our podcast listeners to abide by, or at least understand, is, as you said, get your ducks in a row, as Chris put it, get your facts straight, as I would put it, make sure you know what it is you want to do, and go in there and be adamant if you really feel this is the way you need to do things, or, as this gentleman did, if you're told no twice by one office, call another. And that's what he ended up having to do, and it worked out fine for him. He ended up getting the claiming.
Usually by the time you get to the technical expert or manager of that office, you'll start to get pretty reliable information. It's pretty rare that things escalate to the technical expert, and there's still an issue. That does happen occasionally, but it's usually the frontline folks that when you have a particularly complicated case or something that is out of the ordinary, might not understand the details. It's a very large operations manual for Social Security for a very good reason. There's always these one-offs and exceptions and strange restrictions and controls that take a while to understand. So it's the more I learn about it, the more I realize there's stuff I don't know. It's one of those kinds of situations.
Absolutely. Okay, well, speaking of that, let's start with our first Social Security question.
Okay.
Then we'll probably answer another Social Security question and then get into some non-Social Security questions so I can at least pepper the show with different Q's and A's so the Q's aren't all the same. The A's will always be different, but the Q's, excuse me, the Q's could be very similar if we just keep asking Social Security Q's. This one, you actually reached out directly to the person and answered it for her. I think there was a little bit of a time constraint for her. So I'll read the question, and then if you can't remember your answer, you're more than welcome to read your answer.
Hopefully I'll recall.
Well, it's only from a month ago.
Oh.
So it's not too bad. It begins, "Hi," and this is from a listener in California.
Okay.
"Hi, we used to get our Social Security paper statement in the mail every 6 months. We don't anymore. On that paper, it said the name of the company we used to work for." And then she put in parentheses, "I cannot remember all the places that I used to work. One company I worked for went out of business and is now called something totally different. How do I get my retirement information from that company that doesn't exist anymore? I used to work at," and she named the company, "I won't. They lost a very big contract in a new company," I won't name the new company because it's a well-known company, "took over. I've tried calling who I thought could help me, but I never got a call back. Who should I contact at all these different companies if I don't know where they are anymore?"
Okay, so there's a couple things. I don't think the statement she was getting was actually from Social Security. Either that or she was misremembering. Way back in the day, and this goes back now 6 or 7 years, you used to receive a Social Security statement in the month prior to your birthday. As you approached your birthday, they'd send you one annual, not twice a year, but one annual statement. Well, in a cost-saving measure, they stopped sending them out, and they first tried to stop sending them out completely and force people to create an online account where they could check it. Well, there was an uproar over that, so they've now settled back on a procedure or a policy where they send them out every 5 years until you reach, I think it's 60, and then at 60, you start to receive them again yearly. So that kind of is a balance between shutting it off for people who really don't need it every single year if they're in their 30s or something. But that, and on the form or on the statement itself, it does not list your employer. Nowhere on there does it mention the employer. It has your earnings history on there, reported by all your employers, but it doesn't single them out. So your Social Security statement, first, that explains why you're not receiving them anymore. They didn't say how old they were, but as they are approaching 60, they'll start to see them more frequently. But I think the best bet in this case would be to contact the Department of Labor, and they will have records of all of the ERISA retirement plans. So these, it sounds like it was a fairly old company, probably was an employer-sponsored plan, which falls under the purview of the Department of Labor, and they can help you track down what happened to that. There should be an administrator still for that pension plan that you had, and they can help you track it down. There also, another option would be tax records. It's a little tough now to get information from the IRS, but there's a possibility that the IRS could help you out with some old employer names. But if we're talking a long, long time ago, I think that's a stretch. I think the best bet is the Department of Labor or a company that you know that has a connection to your old company. Maybe it was absorbed into this new company, or the new company took over the contract or something like that. But unfortunately, it's not as simple as asking for a new Social Security statement, because the statement isn't going to reveal what you're looking for. Sound good, Jim?
Yes, very good.
Thanks for...
Well, I was writing. You got me right in the middle of writing an important
that.
Note to myself.
Should I play background music?
No. Oh, God, that's right. We're recording and you need me. Okay. Let me grab another question here. I'm sorry. That's what happens when you try to do 14 things at once. We will answer another Social Security question and then a non-Social Security question. Okay. I have been reading your social... we're back to Georgia again.
A lot from Georgia.
We've got a lot of questions from Georgia. Mm-hmm. So this is a Georgian. Mm-hmm. I have been reading your Social Security blog and enjoy how far-reaching on Social Security it covers. Well, that's a good shout-out to the blog. HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A good shout out. That said, I'm confused on one area, and that is WEP. And then he just put WEP, but I'll let readers know, not readers, listeners know, he's talking about the windfall elimination provision. He goes on to say, I am 61. My non-Social Security paid pension. So he's saying he did not pay into Social Security when he was subject to this pension or earning money towards this pension. My non-Social Security pension is $1,298 a month. I also receive a military pension of $75,000. I'm guessing that's annual, not monthly.
Yes.
Or I would have joined the military for that. I have 28 years of substantial earnings. At age 62, the Social Security Administration estimates my benefit will be $1,627. But I don't think that accounts for WEP. Should I expect a reduction? Would it be $440 plus an additional $85, which is the estimate for 2019?
And that's the end of the question?
Yeah.
First of all...
I would explain to people what WEP is.
You would? Go ahead.
No, you can.
Oh, you want me to?
Yeah.
Okay.
You do it much better. You're
good.
Much more succinct.
I see. Well, I'll give it a try.
10 words or less.
So WEP is complicated. There's
there
three words.
That about sums it up.
And it reduces your benefit. How about that? So when you work in jobs where you pay into an alternative to Social Security, that's what he's referring to there. He had employment with an employer, usually a government agency of some sort, that didn't participate in Social Security but had an alternative. This is quite common with state and federal government workers, although a lot of states and federal government agencies have moved to a combination Social Security and other retirement plan together. So a lot of current workers will still participate as normal in Social Security. But many people have this situation where they worked outside of Social Security, but also had jobs where they participated in Social Security. And that's what he talks about when he says he has 28 years of substantial earnings. That's important because there is a point where, well, let me describe WEP and then I'll tell you how he's going to avoid it for the most part. So WEP essentially stands for Windfall Elimination Provision, and it's designed to prevent someone from having an overly beneficial formula for their Social Security benefit because they had this split time in Social Security and out of Social Security. For those of you who don't know, Social Security is biased in how much it pays out for low wage or low earnings workers. A much higher percentage of their pay is replaced by Social Security than higher wage earners. And so the situation that they're trying to prevent is someone works a little bit in Social Security and then outside of Social Security, if you look at just their Social Security benefits, it looks like they were a low-wage earner, but in fact, they had maybe a very, very high-end career making a lot of money, but they're still benefiting from the favorable formula in Social Security because they only have, you know, half the number of years or who knows, you know, what would cause it to be lower. To prevent that, they alter the formula in such a way that in 2018, it can reduce your benefit up to about $450 a month. That goes up to about $463 a month in 2019. That's the biggest penalty possible. But that penalty, that reduction of your benefit, can be lessened the more you have substantial earnings history in the Social Security system. And that's where his comment about having 28 of those comes in. Up to 20 years of substantial earnings, you get the full force of WEP. You'll have the entire roughly, we'll just keep it a nice round number, the $450 reduction in your Social Security benefit. No matter what it was, it's going to be reduced by $450 per month.
Or no more than half your pension.
Or no more than, there is a limit.
Whatever's
if
lower.
You have the non-Social Security pension, if it's tiny, they will limit that $450. But it sounds like he worked quite a lot because he has a $75,000 pension. So that's not going to protect him because he has such a giant non-Social Security pension. So he's going to be subject to that, but only if he worked less than 20 years in the Social Security system substantially. Well, he's got 28 years. And as it turns out, once you get to 30 years, they say, okay, we're not going to apply WEP to you at all. And between 20 and 30 years, it gradually decreases the effect of WEP. Well, he's almost to 30. He's at 28 years. So the simple short answer that I could have given to him if I didn't give all this extra description,
yeah, you're as bad as me,
was that, yes, you'll be affected by WEP, but only a small amount. You've almost got full protection from WEP. If you could find a way to get two more years of substantial earnings, it would be completely off the table for affecting you. But in your case, I would have to go back and look at the percentages. But I think it was only maybe $60 or $70 a month or something. He was. I think you have my original answer back for him.
No, I didn't have
you
it.
You didn't? Okay. So it's going to be very limited. If he had fewer than 20 years of substantial earnings, whatever Social Security benefit it said he was going to receive, you'd reduce that number by about $450.
I would. Well, it's not going to be as easy as what I make it sound out to be because it has to get substantial earnings, which is, I think, $28,000 right now.
It varies by year. They adjust that number for inflation, and it's in the mid-20s, about $25,000,
$26,000.
I can look that up while...
So he could always go get two more years of substantial earnings, but he indicated he would like to retire. So it might not be worth it to him to work two more years and find a job that will pay him at least what substantial earnings is. And do it for two more years so he'll not be subject to WEP at all. But I tend to agree with Chris, listener, because you have more than 20 years of substantial earnings. That's the key. You have more than 20 years, but less than 30. So for every year between 20 and 30 that you have substantial earnings, you will reduce your WEP penalty. There's 10 years between those two numbers, so 20 and 30.
2018, the amount you have to earn in a year to count for substantial earnings is $23,850.
Oh, okay.
So it's going to be in 2019. That's the 2018 number. The 2019 number is going to be higher than that. It'll be more than 24,000, but probably not quite 25.
So what I was getting at, listener, you are 8 years in. So you're at 28. There's only 2 years left on the reduction in WEP. It's called right. Bend points. We don't want to get into how they do it. But with just two, Chris, I can't see the hit being that substantial. So his question of, is it going to reduce me 440? No. Chris thought it's going to be closer to 60, 70 bucks per yeah. month, not 440 as he wrote. And he said it's going up another $80 for 2019. No, that's not going to hit you.
Not him, though.
Not him.
Right. For others who have less than have 20
years.
Or less years in
it's
Social Security,
yeah.
it's going to hit
be.
You by
if
that
we
amount.
We give you a good hit. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of clients who are exposed to it, and they're none too pleased. But in his case, I don't think it's going to be nearly as bad as he thinks. He said his benefit without WEP was $1,600 a month. I think he's going to still get the vast, vast majority
he
of
is.
That.
Yep, yep, he should.
I would not worry about that, listener. Okay, maybe we'll get to a non-Roth.
Non-Social Security?
Non-Social Security.
Maybe a Roth one? Is that why it was on your mind?
No. I don't know how I had Roth on my mind. You know me, I sometimes just say whatever.
Just blurt out words.
Whatever is there just happens to come out. Okay, I'm trying to see here. This will be good for next week for Peter. Peter Scott, by the way, listeners, will be on next week's show. Peter Scott is the estate planning attorney who I had the pleasure of working with for years. He decided to retire last year. He's still trying to retire. Last I heard, he's going to be fully retired come April 15th of next year. That's the steadfast date that him and his wife have agreed will be when they stop working. But I did succeed, Chris, in getting Pete to come out next week to record some estate planning questions.
Nice. Good.
So anyways, we'll skip that one. I'm trying to find my non-Social Security ones, and I can't find the darn thing. I got another Social Security one I can ask you.
You had it momentarily ago.
I know. You saw what's looking around here. There's a ton of stuff everywhere. Okay, I found it.
Perfect.
This one is from the fine state. It's got to be beautiful this time of year there. Where would you want to be right now if you wanted beauty?
Where would I be right now if I wanted beauty?
In one of the 50 states. Keeping in mind it's fall, mid-November.
Arizona?
What the hell would you want to be in Arizona for?
Because it's fall.
It's all brown.
It's all
I said beauty.
Snowy here. Oh, beauty?
Beauty.
Hawaii?
No, Burlington, Vermont.
This time of year?
Vermont's beautiful with all the foliage.
Isn't it already cold there?
Well, it's called fall.
No, I mean colder. Aren't they getting snow there already like we are?
I don't know.
Oh. I'm sure Vermont's beautiful. That's not the top of my mind. All right,
never mind. This is from a listener in Vermont. Listener, if I had my choice, I would rather be in Vermont than Arizona. Just want to throw that out there. Greetings from Burlington, Vermont. I am a new listener to your podcast. I have a question on blended funds. For instance, and he lists several funds by name. I don't want to mention them because you know it sends compliance into a tizzy fit if we actually mention the names of funds. We'll just talk about them in the broad category that he calls blended funds.
Which you define as what, Jim?
I will explain that in 1 second
okay.
once I answer his questions.
Okay.
My question is, how would I look at that style fund when it comes to decumulation planning during my retirement? And if it is held in a taxable portfolio, what bucket should it be? Thanks. and then he lists his name, actually his initials. But we won't even use his initials. We're going to protect his anonymity, and as we always do, we're going to call him George.
Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
So when I first read this email, if he didn't actually list, Chris, some fund examples by name, and the two he listed, I know those funds quite well, I would have been a little confused because blended funds aren't an organized category. Blended funds do exist. There's a name out there, but one fund company may use the term, or one advisor may call some style fund a blended fund, and another advisor says, no, that's not a blended fund. These are blended funds.
Right. There's no rule that says specifically what a blended fund is.
But the examples he gave are what I call allocation funds. Now, that's the name I have given them. Just like blended fund isn't necessarily a steadfast rule, the verbiage allocation fund doesn't have a steadfast rule, but it's what I call them. The types of funds that he is referencing, folks, are funds that set a certain asset allocation and will own, or certain risk level rather, excuse me, let me put it that way, will set a certain level of risk, Chris, and then they will manage for that level of risks by owning a blend of different assets, cash, stocks, bonds. Some will own foreign, some will own growth and value, small, mid, large. Some will own alternative assets, commodities. So they're blended, hence the name blend. It's like a blender. You put all these different things in a blender and you hit press or start or whatever the hell it is. And the thing turns on and everything gets blended. I just got a Nutribullet. So I'm into this whole blending thing, making those health shakes.
They do a very good job on milkshakes, too.
No, you're supposed to buy it. I'm putting kale in mine. I got kale.
No, you don't put kale in a milkshake.
No, but you put it in the Nutribullet with apples and kale.
When you're done with that, though, you can put ice cream and milk and chocolate syrup in there, and it's a glorious.
Is it glorious?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Well, you won't be happy.
You can blend like a single serving of your favorite milkshake in there.
So you can get a whole pint of Ben and Jerry's and drink it.
I think you're missing the point of a shake. Ben and Jerry's has its own gloriousness off to the side, but sorry to derail you there.
Anyways, so blended is like a blender. You put in a bunch of different asset classes and you hit blend. The whole point of a blended fund is they intend to maintain, Chris, their level of risk forever. They're not like a life cycle fund. Those are the funds with the numbers, the years after them. If you have a 401k, you probably have seen life cycle funds, and they'll have numbers like 2030, 2035, 2040, 2045. And those funds cycle or will move towards a stated asset allocation a little bit every year. So that fund is always moving, hence the name cycle. And it's life cycle because it cycles over your life. Whereas these, I call them again, allocation funds. He used the verbiage blended funds. Other advisors or the fund families themselves may call them something else. But they will state a level of risk that they intend to assume. Or they would state, Chris, a given asset allocation. We're going to have 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Or we're going to have 60% stocks, 35% bonds, 5% cash. Or you get the picture. Mm-hmm. It can be anything. Right. So an allocation fund, unlike a life cycle fund, will maintain that given level of risk. I actually like these funds. He asked, what is my thoughts on them? I like them. I think for a variety of reasons. I'll share a true story here, Chris, but I am not going to name the fund. About 6 years ago now, I was in Denver for a retirement planning symposium. Mm-hmm. I won't say which one it is. And I was there And I was brand new to this symposium. I was new to the group that was sponsoring the symposium. I was not the Ed Slot group. And I was a newbie, so I was there, and they were having their review. They never done it in Denver since. But I thought, oh, God, since they're right here in Denver and I just joined this group, I'm going to go down there and do this because I'm a retirement planner. When I was there, I befriended another advisor who turned out, go figure, to be from Colorado. And this was right around or shortly after the market calamity of 08 and 09. And a lot of the discussion at lunch was on, what are you doing for your clients? How are you managing portfolios? How were you burned by this massive fall in the markets, and what are you doing? And asset allocation was the overriding discussion. Well, we have to diversify. We have to own multiple assets. And people were just sharing all their investment ideas. I had decided as a firm that I was going to embark on something different. I don't want to bore our listeners with what I was contemplating at the time. But I started talking to this advisor who turned out to be from Boulder, Colorado. And he and I struck up a friendship. And we actually shared a ride home that day. I had received a ride into Denver that day. And my girlfriend at the time, yes, I was dating at the time, she was going to drive down to Denver and pick me up. And I didn't have to. She worked in Boulder. And I texted her and says, hey, I met a guy. He's going to take me into Boulder. So we chatted a lot. And he asked me on the ride, what was I doing? And what I had decided to do was to utilize a lot of these allocation funds in my portfolio under a strategy called Core Satellite. Because I started realizing these funds, and what I like about these funds, listener, these funds are generally group managed, I found. Some of them aren't. There's a couple. I don't want to name them. They're managed by individuals. They have a really good year. They have a really bad year. You know, the person's on, the person's off. But if you think about it, these funds are owning, Chris, stocks, bonds, cash, sometimes foreign equity, sometimes emerging markets, commodities, alternatives. They're diversifying the risk out of the portfolio. And I thought to myself, one person can't do this. I want to find these funds that are group managed. And it also started highlighting my own fallacy of trying to manage portfolios. Because these asset managers, Chris, they do it 24/7. Mm-hmm. That's all these people do. Whereas a financial planner like we are, I might look at the market every day, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes here. I might read a summary from Barron's or the Wall Street Journal in the evening of what the markets did to get a general flair of what's going on. But 90% of my day, Chris, is spent trying to help people retire, help do retirement planning, tax optimization, Roth conversion strategies. It's not watching the market. So I started realizing that these funds would form a good base of a portfolio. So I shared that with this guy as we're driving to mm-hmm. Boulder. And he says to me, do you mind if I ask you a couple of the funds you're using? And I told him the name of one of the funds. And he said, don't talk to me about that fund. I hate it. And he's not saying anything. He's still driving. I think by now we're on 36 heading into Boulder. And I'm sitting there. Can you tell me more? I mean, what do you mean? I like this fund. Mm-hmm. So I looked at him and I says, what do you mean you hate it? This gentleman was not a financial planner. And he freely would admit that. He was an investment advisor. He managed portfolios for clients. This is his exact, it's not the exact quote, but the exact, what do you call it? It's when it's not really what he said, but it's damn close.
It's not verbatim.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. This is what he said to me. He looked at me, and let's just say that the fund is the XYZ fund. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say what fund this is. He looked at me, and he said, I self-benchmark my client portfolios to that XYZ fund to measure how I am doing and I am not making this up, Chris. He said, I have never been able to beat that fund. And if my clients knew, they would question what they're paying me for. And the man was totally serious. That man, sad, sad story, has passed away. And it's not been that far. This happened about 6 years ago. But he did share that
so
with me.
So he clearly wasn't divulging to his clients that he was benchmarking. He was personally, that's what he means.
No, privately.
He was just, would look at himself and self-reflect on this. He wasn't putting out in their monthly newsletter, hey, look,
here's what you could do if you bought this fund.
Right, with a lot lower costs.
He never could beat it.
Yeah.
Now, this fund, it's managed. It's a West Coast fund family. It's well managed. I'll tell you after we record who it is. You'll recognize the fund family. Well known, well respected in the industry. I bet you a lot of our listeners have never heard of this fund or fund family. It's not a huge... If you're in our industry, you've heard of this fund. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, you might never have heard of it. They don't have a big marketing budget. They don't push like a Vanguard or a Fidelity or a T. Rowe Price. You'll never see an ad for this company. But if you read Money Magazine or Kiplinger's or anything like that, every once in a while, the managers of this funds are always quoted because they're that good. But anyways... He said to me, he said, the majority of my portfolios are moderate risk. This particular fund is a moderate risk allocation fund. And he said, again, as a measure, he would self-benchmark his portfolios to it, and he could never beat it. That was eye-opening to me. I sat there as we drove into Boulder. I couldn't get that out of my mind. And part of what he shared with me is part of how I changed dramatically how we manage assets for clients. And then I took it one step further. About 3 years ago, I embraced a lot more passive investing because a lot of the reason this gentleman couldn't beat this fund is he was charging massive fees. It was more than 1%. I think he was at 1.25 or 1.75, I can't remember, just for him to manage your portfolio. And then he did it utilizing individual equities, ETFs, and so he had to pay trading costs, and he just, the costs wouldn't allow him to do that, but he was trying to do too much all by himself, in my humble opinion. You can't do what these firms do on these types of allocation funds or what this listener called a blended fund. Now, blended funds or what I call allocation funds come in generally three flavors, like Napoleon ice cream. Neapolitan.
There you go.
Neapolitan. And isn't that a place in Italy?
Naples.
Naples, whatever. Is that where you get ice cream?
I doubt it. They're probably gelato over there.
Oh. But just like that
Neapolitan.
Neapolitan is chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. These funds come conservative, moderate, or aggressive. It's usually the three flavors of an allocation fund you'll get. The particular fund that I'm sharing in that story is a moderate allocation fund. The two funds that he told me, one is moderate, one is conservative, although I would argue both are moderate, if you want my opinion. But Morningstar doesn't quite agree with me on that, or should I say I don't quite agree with Morningstar on their assessment. And you don't have as many conservative allocation funds. They're a very rare breed. I know of about 6 or 7. In the moderate category, Chris?
There's a bunch.
There is a bunch, yeah. Absolutely. Dozens upon dozens upon dozens. And then in the aggressive, surprisingly, you don't see many for one simple reason. Aggressive would be 90% equities, and at that point, you might as well buy a low-cost index fund tracking a broad market and then throw 10% in a low-cost bond fund, and you can probably beat any allocation fund. So that's why you don't see many on the aggressive side, but they do exist. We as a firm have looked at them, and Travis, the chartered financial analyst who works for us, he agreed. He said, Jim, there's none I would own. He said, you're better off just buying a low-cost index fund, 100% equities, and put 10% of your money in a bond fund, and there's your these funds, because of the fees, Chris, the management fees of the fund, there were no good aggressive ones. So the majority of them are in the moderate category. Mm-hmm. They are tremendous amount. And if you find a really good one, listener, I think they're a wonderful way where you are not actually having to do the due diligence of a moderate portfolio. And these groups that manage, the management structure is generally a group. There'll be maybe one or two portfolio managers who make the ultimate decisions of how much stocks, how much bonds can equal a moderate a level of risk. Because if you read the portfolio of these funds, Chris, they don't generally lock themselves in. I know of one that does handcuff them and saying, we will own no more than X percent equities. Most give a very broad amount. I've seen some, they can own as little as 10% to as much as 90% equities.
Gives them a lot of freedom.
Freedom to move. What they say is they will not assume more than a given amount of risk. And that's how some of them measure, is purely by risk. Others will do their measure purely by asset allocation. They'll say, we are going to maintain no more than X percent. Now the one that I mentioned that goes from 10 to 90, that's very broad. On a moderate, you might see 50-50, 60-40, 70-30. They'll give you the measures of how they're going to manipulate the portfolio to stay within a moderate level of risk. But if you're looking for a moderate level of risk, which we have said time and time again on this show, is a very reasonable level of risk to assume as a pre- or post-retiree. Now, it's not to say it's appropriate for you, but it is a very reasonable level to begin measuring your risk tolerance from. And if you don't want to do it all yourself, and you don't want to get involved in a program that may manage assets based on different structures, and you just kind of want to do it yourself, or better yet, Chris, you don't have enough money to really blend out and purchase Morningstar's moderate risk benchmark. It has 18 different asset classes that Morningstar tracks and breaks up into different percentages to come up with what they feel is a moderate risk portfolio. If you don't have enough assets to be able to run out and take meaningful positions in 18 different asset classes, these funds are perfect. So he wanted to, well, I don't know if we can use the word perfect. They're a perfect fund to think of as a possible source or use for that. How's that? Because I think your clients will like that a little better.
Sure.
But what I'm trying to get our listener to understand is those funds, if you find a really good one, and they're out there, there are some phenomenal ones, they can really make your life easier. The fees are very reasonable. The two that he mentioned have rather low fees. I wouldn't say very low fees, but rather low fees. Been around a long time. One of the funds, I think, was one of the original funds ever created in the early 1930s. And they just have a simple approach. They're going to manage through a wide variety of assets for a stated level of risk. And again, most of them, like Neapolitan, nailed it. Neapolitan ice cream, strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate. They usually come conservative, moderate, or aggressive. And then he wanted to know what bucket would these funds represent. That's a tough one because in bucketing, we call it visualized asset allocation. You have your cash in one pool, your principal protected in another pool, and your equities in another pool. So you can spend from each bucket depending on what the market's doing. When you own everything in one fund like this, And let's just say it's a 60-40 mix, Chris, and they're going to maintain a moderate portfolio, 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And you're looking on their website and you see that, wow, the stock market is down. So 60% of this portfolio is down. But wow, the other 40% that they have in cash and bonds, according to their latest printout, it's doing pretty good. It's up. I want to just sell that. The market's down. I don't want to sell the things that are down. You can't do that.
No.
So that's a downside to these funds. So where would they fit in? Obviously, they're not a bucket one, which is liquid, fully cash, 100% principal protection. That's not it. They're not a bucket two, in my opinion, because they aren't principal protected. So they could be viewed as a bucket three. Even though I think if you have a bucketing plan in place, your bucket three, which is your investment pool, money that you're not going to need hopefully for 10 years or more, although some people go 6 to 8 years, but we prefer 10 or so years before you need it. This fund would be a good bucket three if you don't have the risk tolerance.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
To take on more risk.
If your crazy uncle bucket, which is what we call it, because it's much more volatile and unpredictable compared to the other buckets, that bucket, if you still don't want it to be particularly crazy, you know, particularly volatile, you might have a very low risk tolerance, and you could certainly mitigate that risk by having a more conservative allocation like you could get with one of these blended funds or other methods. There's other ways of doing it. This isn't the only way, right. But this could, I agree with Jim, that this could find itself into the third bucket in our bucketing strategy, if you will, or technique, if you happen to be lower risk tolerance than
right. Very
than
risk
average.
Averse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or if you're trying to help someone who doesn't have much money and they don't have enough. These funds are wonderful. The funds that he referenced have $3,000 minimums in non-qualified, which would be a regular brokerage style account. And I think the minimum in an IRA is as little as $500. So you can find very low minimums. You can get professional management. Many of them have very low costs and are very well managed, like the few that I've been referencing. I know I haven't given the names, and it's not that we're trying to be secretive or we want you to call us for the name. That's not why we do it, because Chris and I are practicing, living, breathing financial planners. We can talk about funds by their category, but as soon as we mention a name, the disclosures we would have to play on this show would be wicked long.
Yeah.
If compliance would even let me do it. So sometimes people say, well, how does someone else do it, like Dave Ramsey? Dave Ramsey is not a practicing financial planner. He can say whatever the hell he wants.
Right.
My hero, Rick Eidelman, he's under the RIA structure. They have slightly different rules than what I have to do under the Cambridge structure. So there's all different reasons why other radio people can get away with it, and we can't. It's just the way the industry is. So I'm not trying to be secretive on these names. It's just for a variety of reasons we can't say them, at least right now. But I like the funds. They're not perfect, but for small investors, for non-sophisticated investors, for someone who just wants it easy now, they just don't feel like dealing with it anymore. I don't feel like rebalancing my portfolio. I don't feel like doing this, that, or the other thing. And I would even go so far as to say, if you're working with an advisory firm, ask them what their thoughts are on these funds. And again, it was very eye-opening when this gentleman said he self-benchmarks his portfolio to that fund and he has never beaten it. It told me there, Chris, that fund had been on my radar for a very long time. When he told me that, I thought to myself, this is a fund I have to look at closer. If this guy can't beat it, and during our stay for the 2 days down in Denver before we drove back up to Boulder, during my stay down here, his whole tenet, as he was telling me about his business model, was asset management. It's just, you know, mm-hmm. he manages assets for clients. People pay him. He was working with very high net worth people. He only had a handful of clients. And that was how his business was structured. That's all he wanted, was to work with a handful of clients who had to have very, very, very high minimums. And for him to admit that he couldn't beat that fund was eye-opening. And what he said afterwards, if my clients knew, they would question why they're paying
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
Interesting. But anyways, that's my thought on those funds.
Okay.
It's a category you don't hear much about because investment advisors don't like to talk about them because they investment advisors like you to think that investing is so complex you need them and you need to pay them 1.5%, 1.25% and they're going to design something that's beautiful for you and give you bragging rights at the next cocktail party. So they're not going to come out and tell you about these funds.
No.
And we do. I like them. I'm not going to dispute it. And for a lot of our smaller clients, they're in these mm-hmm. funds. And that's how it's done.
Yep.
Okay. Do we have time for one more Social Security question? I hope so.
Yeah.
Because we only got through two.
Yeah, let's do one more.
Okay. Wow, this has to be a mistake.
Maybe the default is Georgia.
Maybe we already answered these questions.
Not the last one.
We didn't?
Not that last one.
Well, I'm going to start reading this, and if we've already answered it, let me know, because it too. Oh, I see why. Same listener.
Oh, asking several questions.
Several questions.
There you go.
Sneaky.
Mm-hmm.
Sneaky. Okay.
It's all good.
We have another Georgian.
It's like having a person in class that asks all the questions for the whole class.
Yeah, that's what this guy's doing.
Mm-hmm.
This one is going to be more of an opinion. I'll let you answer because if I get going, Lord knows how long that'll take.
Okay.
One point often made in favor of delaying Social Security is that it would be difficult to make 8% a year on your own investment.
Mm.
He's kind of misunderstanding what the 8% additional
yeah.
is.
Yep.
I'd like you, I don't understand what the word is he's trying to say here. I'd like you to teat that. T-E-A-T, what does that mean?
I think he meant something else.
Okay. I'd like you to teat that with the following assumptions. I'm going to die at 80. And I don't need any money from Social Security. Well, now he's really changing it here.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I take my Social Security at 62 and invest that reduced amount and make X percent annually, I will have the potential for more money at age 80 than taking my money, my Social Security at 70 and investing it and earning the exact same rate of return. So what are your thoughts?
I think he's looking at the choice of claiming at 62 versus 70 through the wrong lens, if you will. The first of all, if he's assuming he's going to pass away at 80, if you look first at the total amount of Social Security you're going to receive, you'll receive more if you claim early. Because the assumption with Social Security, where we call it, you know, a lot of people just refer to it as the break even, where you're going to win or lose, have more or less being paid to you over time, over your lifespan, is up into the 80s, into the low 80s, 83, 84. So if he's assuming he's going to be on the short end of that, the earlier claiming is going to outweigh the higher amount being paid because he'll collect for more years. If he assumed he was going to live till 90, that answer flips as far as just the question of how much total am I going to receive.
He also misses the boat a little, Chris. In my opinion, Social Security and the whole idea of waiting to earn 8% annual delayed retirement credits, here is definitely a do-it-yourselfer investment guy.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to be talking with the other gentleman I just spoke about, the other investment advisor who unfortunately has passed away. But because he's trying to take something which is longevity insurance, which is what Social Security is, and simplicity and guaranteed insurity, and compare it to the uncertainty and unknown and risk of an investment. But But the whole idea of earning delayed retirement credits, 8% more Social Security per year between your full retirement age and age 70, that 8% is more income is not the equivalent, Chris, of 8% greater return on an investment.
Correct. And we did, I did a study for somebody a number of years ago. So these numbers aren't going to hold anymore because there's differences in inflation assumptions and interest rates and that sort of thing these days. But the right way to compare that wouldn't be to compare how much money you will have in your hands at age 80, but rather by delaying, what would it cost you to purchase a larger Social Security equivalent, which would be an inflation-adjusted annuity for life, which is what Social Security is. Social Security is not a lump sum amount that's an investment. So he's kind of comparing his apples and oranges here. But it turned out when I did this study, because they had a similar question, why should I delay? Well, the answer was because for you to buy an annuity that pays you as much as Social Security would, 32% more by delaying from 66 to 70, you'd have to create a lump sum amount to buy an annuity over that time period. You'd have to take the money you were being paid and invest it and earn rates up in the 20s, high 20s.
It was crazy.
It was crazy high rate of return. And if you told someone you have to assume a rate of return of 28% or something like that, they say, oh, yeah, that's crazy. Well, that was the whole point of the study. Yes, that is crazy. Now, he's trying to look at it as how much is he going to have in a pot, in a box at age 80? Well, my first question is, why do you care? You're assuming you're dead at 80.
Exactly.
That's the first question I'd ask. Now, is it to leave a legacy for your children? If that's the purpose, then maybe it does make perfect sense to collect early, take those proceeds, and maybe, you know, buy life insurance, invest it, do whatever you want with it that are going to benefit your offspring.
And that's what I was.
But he's trying to compare apples, oranges, and pineapples here. It's not an easy and appropriate direct comparison.
And I just want to throw out two more caveats out to him. He wanted us to actually figure out X for him. He says, what does X need to be to make this ring true if I had an average Social Security distribution? This would be a junior question. This would be, Justin would have loved something like this. He would have written a spreadsheet in about 20 minutes on
it. Well, that's similar to what I did for those people.
Right.
We solved for X. What rate of return would I have
to
earn?
Well, we're not going to do that here. I'm not going to determine what X is. But I want to point out to him a couple of things. First, you said in your email you don't need the Social Security. He said, first, assume I don't need the Social Security. So he probably foresaw us going down that road that, hey, you might need this money or you might need more money, so you're going to want to delay. He's trying to take that right off the table. So it tells me what you just said, Chris. He's trying to build a legacy for someone, whether it's his children or someone else. But he also has shorter than average life expectancy because he's saying assume death at 80. So that tells me he's not going to probably be able to run out and buy life insurance, because if you want to maximize an investment over a 17-year period, I don't know of anything that's going to beat life insurance for a healthy person. If the healthy person knew they were going to die in 17 years and knew the life insurance people weren't going to be able to figure that out and they were going to give them a good rating, the internal rate of return on a life insurance policy, Chris, for someone who is preferred or preferred plus after 17 years, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, it's telling me he's not going to be able to go out and buy life insurance. He thinks he has a shorter than average life expectancy, or even if he did get written, the internal rate of return may not be there because he has such a short life expectancy. So he's looking to invest. So if you don't need the money, listener, and you're looking to invest and you're wondering what's going to be better, claim now at 63 or 7 years later at 70. I would say, how do you think your investments are going to perform? If you think the investments over the coming 7 years are going to be like the last 7 years and nothing is ever going to go bad and the investments aren't going to drop and they're going to do good, I think getting less money out 7 years sooner because of the power of compounding, which is the eighth wonder of the world, is going to blow away more money, but for a shorter period of time, 10 years. He said, let's assume my rate of return is identical on both portfolios at age 70. So from that standpoint, it's telling me he may want to take the money out earlier. Now, if he's worried about the markets, I would still lean towards taking the money out earlier. If all things are going to be equal, the only reason I'm saying that is what causes a lot of the market drops cause problems, Chris, when you have a static portfolio, when you're not putting money in anymore. And you just had an investment that was once worth $1 million and now it's worth $500,000 because the market's down 50%. And you're not buying. You're not taking advantage of that drop. The people who make money are the people who buy when things are down. If you don't have the money to do that, yes, a market drop was lost opportunity for you. If you're just waiting for the market to recover and then begin growing, that's what we call in the industry lost opportunity. But if he is taking money from Social Security, Chris, every month, because your checks come monthly, and he starts dollar cost averaging in, even though he's a retiree, he has the opposite of sequential risk happening to him. He has dollar cost averaging, which is a good thing. As the market is going down, he's buying more and more shares. Let's just assume, let's borrow from what we just said two questions ago. The listener with the allocation fund, he finds a good, simple allocation fund. As the portfolio, as the market is dropping, his monthly Social Security checks are buying more shares of that. So when the market recovers, his greater shares are growing sooner. So I wouldn't overstress that, oh, the market's overvalued. Maybe I'll delay Social Security until it corrects and then buy. I would start buying on a simple dollar cost averaging. You're not taking money out of the portfolio. So sequential losses early in retirement is going to be good for you when you are saving. He's kind of taking an accumulation route. He said he's not going to spend any of the money. Mm-hmm. And he's anticipating not needing it until 80 when he dies. So as I read that question, I thought, to hell with this 8% delayed retirement credits. That's an income benefit for someone with longevity. You don't have that. So the question becomes, are you better off investing less money 7 years earlier than more money 7 years later with two identical rates of return? I think because of the power of compounding, it would be wiser to invest earlier. And if the timing is off and the market's going down, who cares? A little every month going in with that disciplined approach for 17 years, I think is a good thing.
Right. And if he's trying to leave something to his heirs, there's other aspects that benefit that situation, like the step up in basis that you're going to have. Hopefully over that long period of time, you've had a lot of capital gains in your investments, and all of that then becomes tax-free for the heirs. So there's other, you know, auxiliary benefits also to amassing a portfolio that has gains in it over time. But you're opening yourself up to the risk of things not going up. You know, it's the investments don't just go up. They go up and down.
But with a 17-year time horizon,
a long enough period that
it's dollar cost averaging. You want it to be on sale. When you're buying something, do you want, I mean, I'm drinking a Starbucks coffee right here. This damn thing was $6.71 today. Oh, it's a triple venti, this, that, and the other thing. But on Friday after 3, this exact coffee last Friday after 3 was on sale 50% off.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Now, did I run screaming, refusing to pay 50% off? And did I demand to speak to the manager of when this is going to be at full price again because that's when I want to buy it? Hell no. I bought two.
You did?
Yeah.
What'd you do with them?
I put one in the fridge and nuked it the next day, and I drank one on the way home.
I didn't know you could keep it. You can have leftover coffee?
Yeah, you just nuke it. There's so much cream, sugar, and artificial stuff in this Starbucks coffee. You can't tell when you nuke it. It just tastes as good.
Huh. I didn't know that.
But what I'm getting at, with a 17-year time horizon, I think dollar cost averaging can work for him. I'm making some broad-based assumptions here based on this listener's email. There's no spousal issues going on here. And if there is, he has the smaller of the two benefits, not the larger of the two benefits, because maybe he has a shorter life expectancy, but the spouse obviously, hopefully, would have a longer life expectancy. I'm also assuming perhaps he's single and there is no one else who's going to get a benefit or could be eligible for a benefit under him. And he's just looking to maximize his inheritance. He's not going to qualify for a reasonable internal rate of return on his life insurance because of whatever medical condition is going to cause this much shorter than average life expectancy. And he's just trying to optimize what he can leave because he's not going to be able to collect Social Security for a full life term. So if those broad-based assumptions are his situation, I think turning Social Security on earlier and investing the money to allow your heirs to inherit something from it, Chris, to me makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
How much will he have? I don't know. But the big caveat is, if my assumption is wrong, and listener, what you are actually trying to do is turn Social Security on and amass money and then be able to turn it on into an income stream that pays more than the 8% annual delayed retirement credits because you think your investments are going to earn more than 8%. And I don't think your investments are going to earn more than 8%. I think that's an outrageously high rate of return assumption. But that said, as Chris just talked about, he crunched the numbers and I've crunched the numbers. It doesn't work. And it doesn't work for one simple reason. Well, many simple reasons. But Social Security is based on your earnings. If you try to buy an income stream later that you're going to be able to grow this pool into a large enough amount that you're going to be able to buy more income than the 8% annual delayed retirement credits for 3 or 4 years, depending on when your full retirement age is. Income payments from an annuity, Chris, are not based on your earnings. They're based on current
interest rates.
Exactly. And current interest rates
and your age
are very small. So your payments are very minimal compared to what they would be if interest rates were higher. So I just don't think you would be able to grow the investments to the point where you're going to get a greater return as a delayed retirement credit.
Right.
But if what he's trying to do is maximize an inheritance and he's worried because he doesn't think he's going to live much past 80, if not anything past 80, then I think claiming now a smaller amount and letting it compound for 7 years or begin. Compounding is buying low as well. It's not just buying high. Compounding is getting more shares because the value of your portfolio, folks, this isn't rocket science. Most of you guys are do-it-yourselfers. It's shares times price equals current value. So when the market is going down, you are buying more shares. One of the elements of that formula, Chris, shares times price equals market value. One of those elements is getting bigger and bigger and bigger every month you are buying in a down market because you're getting more and more shares. That's a good thing. So when the market recovers, not if, when, we all know it will recover. When the market recovers, you have more shares times price, you have more money. So That would be my take. But again, without enough info from him, we're very hesitant to say one way or another, and we're certainly not going to figure out what X has to be. That he's going to have to figure that out himself.
Perfect. So we've gotten to the end of another Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. If you'd like to send in your questions, please go to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can send us a question right through that contact form. You can also set up what we call a coffee and a second opinion meeting. It's a phone call where you can talk to Jim. and see if we can do something for you. We can describe your situation, what types of questions you have. We can talk about our process, what kind of benefits we might bring to your situation, or if we can't bring beneficial things to your situation, hopefully we can guide you to somewhere that can. But that is a complimentary meeting, the Coffee and a Second Opinion. You can schedule that right from that same website, jimhelps.com. And what else do you want to mention, Jim?
Well, the Coffee and a Second Opinion meeting is often a Coffee and a Second Opinion phone call.
Right.
As we work with people throughout the United States, we may be based in Colorado, but we are living, breathing financial planners who work with people throughout the United States. We specialize in distribution planning, not accumulation planning. Getting to the top is easy. Getting down is the hard part. How are you going to traverse through retirement until mortality? How are you going to position your assets? How are you going to position your retirement, your income needs, your Social Security, pension, annuities? Do you need annuities or not? How are you going to handle Medicare, Medicaid, taxes, Roth conversions? How is the tax torpedo going to impact your Social Security? What will the widower tax penalty look like? My God, it is so incredibly complex, Chris, on the distribution side. What we do at our firm is we specialize in the distribution planning. So if you want to schedule that Coffee and a Second Opinion phone call, you would visit the website, jimhelps.com, or call the office, and Laura will be happy to schedule that phone call with you. And if you want, we will actually mail you one of our Keurig coffee pods. And the coffee is on us, so you can schedule a Coffee and a Second Opinion phone call and have a free coffee.
Perfect. So thanks for joining us again. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.